Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, is there anything to be scared of from solar storms? And one of the biggest problems in astrophysics, what makes a star go supernova? Here's a scientist soundbite.
Embarrassing might not even be the right word, but here we're using, discovering the expansion of the universe and giving Nobel Prizes, and we don't really know where these things came from.
That's astronomer Brad Schaefer of Louisiana State University. More with him later, but first, Science News of the Week with Emily Howard and Michael Brennan.
The fifth named storm for the 2012 Indian cyclone season, Cyclone Funso, formed in the Mozambique Channel and became a major hurricane with a sustained wind of 140 miles per hour on January 25, 2012. Funso was responsible for providing heavy rains across Mozambique, which is in southeastern Africa. Combined with ample rainfall from a tropical depression the previous week, rainfall totals were over a foot in many areas. Flooding has been a serious issue across Mozambique, resulting in at least 25 deaths.
A dog skull unearthed in Siberia presents some of the oldest known evidence of dog domestication. The ancient skull was preserved in a cave for 33,000 years. Together with equally ancient dog remains from a cave in Belgium, the Siberian dog skull indicates that the relationship between dogs and humans might have occurred repeatedly and in different geographic locations across the Earth, rather than as a single domestication event.
January 25, 2012 was the 8-year anniversary of the safe landing of the Opportunity rover on planet Mars. The rover touched down at 5:05 a.m. UTC on January 25, 2004, for a planned 3-month mission to explore the Red Planet. It was 3 weeks after its twin rover, Spirit, arrived on Mars. 8 years later, Opportunity is still going strong. It's essentially on a new mission, exploring the huge Endeavour crater on Mars, which it reached in August of 2011 after a 3-year, 4.8-mile trek from its previous location.
2011 had the greatest economic losses globally due to earthquakes on record. That's according to an analysis by the Center for Disaster Management and Risk Reduction Technology, released earlier this month. Last year, earthquakes and their consequences, such as tsunamis and landslides, caused a damage of $365 billion. According to this analysis, 20,500 people died from earthquakes and their effects in 2011. About 1 million people lost their homes. Japan and New Zealand were hit hardest.
A large geomagnetic storm caused by an M8.7 class flare on the sun on January 22nd is over. There were reports of amazing displays of the beautiful aurora or northern lights seen at high latitudes on Earth. The Associated Press reported that experienced stargazers were stunned by the intensity of the aurora borealis that swept across the night sky on January 24th. And that's News of the Week. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Upcoming is our Song of the Week. It's called Better Days, and it's by the band The Boxing Lesson, off their upcoming LP. They're heading out on tour this February, so catch them if you can.
We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. Astronomers from Louisiana State University say they've solved a long-standing fundamental problem of what makes a star go supernova, specifically a Type 1A supernova. Astronomers have long considered them standard candles to measure the age of the universe. Their luminosity caps out much like a 60-watt light bulb. The problem is, what creates these supernova, whether they were created by the collision of two compact stars called white dwarfs, or whether just one white dwarf siphons off mass from a companion star to become that supernova. Dr. Schaefer analyzed images from the Hubble Space Telescope to find out that two white dwarfs, 160,000 light-years away, spiraled into each other to create a supernova. Brad Schaefer spoke with Earth Sky in Austin, Texas, January of 2012, at the 219th meeting of the American Astronomical Society.
A Type 1A supernova is a particular type of supernova. It's a big thermonuclear bomb, kind of like an H-bomb, although on a much bigger scale. And these are particularly important for understanding cosmology, the age and the fate of the universe. And the double degenerate part of it there are jargon words for a system where you have two white dwarfs, and those are small, compact core X cores of stars, two white dwarfs going round and round in close orbit around each other, and they ultimately spiral in, and after some relatively long time, they'll spiral in and collide with each other, and when that happens, they explode as one of these Type 1A supernova. It's long been a very big question as to where these Type 1A supernova have come from. We've known about these supernova for 70 years now, but the question is, where do they come from? After large amounts of research, about 30, 40 years ago, people realized that you had to be dealing with part of this system the thing that had to explode would have to be a white dwarf, in particular one made up primarily of carbon and oxygen. And so you have one of these white dwarfs when it gets enough mass, it reaches some upper limit. This upper limit on the mass, when a white dwarf is just that much mass, that will lead to an explosion, fair enough. But the question is, what sort of system can make one of these white dwarfs get to the point where it's at this maximum mass? And there are kind of two general possibilities. One possibility is you have, these two white dwarfs. And if you have the two white dwarfs, when they finally spiral in and hit each other, the combined mass of that white dwarf will be the limit and the thing will explode. Another possibility, it's called a single degenerate model. It's just our jargon. It means, a degenerate star is a white dwarf. And so this single degenerate system is one where you have just one white dwarf. And the other star around it is not a degenerate star, but a normal star, a star like our sun or perhaps a red giant. And again, they're also in close orbit. And what happens is, if you get the orbits close enough, some of the material from the normal star, the companion star, will fall off and fall down onto the white dwarf, where it will slowly but surely increase the mass of the white dwarf. And at some point, the white dwarf will have enough mass that it's going to be at this limit and will start exploding. And so there's long been a tension and an uncertainty back and forth between knowing whether these Type 1A supernova happen to come from this single degenerate or double degenerate, that is, whether they come from a pair of white dwarfs or whether they come from a white dwarf with a companion star spilling matter over onto it.
Dr. Schaefer, did you find the solution to this Type 1 progenitor problem?
Yes, we did. We have indeed found a very decisive solution to the Type 1A progenitor problem, and we used a little bit of an idea here. I had described how there are these two basic classes of models, the double degenerate and the single degenerate. Well, one way you can go distinguishing them is by looking at what's left behind. If you have two white dwarfs spiraling in, basically both white dwarfs get blown up, and you're left with nothing left behind. Alternatively, if it's a single degenerate, you have a white dwarf and a companion star spilling matter over, when the white dwarf blows up, it'll blow off a little bit of the gas on the companion star, but the companion star will be largely intact and not changed, or not changed by much. So the dodge we're using is to try to find out whether there's an ex-companion star left behind after the eruption. So the trick we use is we look inside a supernova remnant. That's a big gas cloud blown out by the explosion of the white dwarf. And somewhere close in the center, deep in the center of that, should be any ex-companion star. So the idea is you pick a good case supernova remnant, hopefully fairly young, and you look deep in the core of that. If you go finding an ex-companion star, bang, you've just proven that it's a single degenerate. If you find no ex-companion star to deep levels, well, there's no ex-companion star, so you've ruled out single degenerate, so it has to be double degenerate. That's the logic we have. So my advance has been to realize that, wow, you can do this exact same task on supernova remnants that appear in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Now, the Large Magellanic Cloud happens to be a fairly small galaxy in orbit around our own Milky Way galaxy, but it's the closest galaxy to our own Milky Way. So there's actually one supernova remnant out of the many in the cloud that's just perfect for our case. Well, it's given a telephone number, SNR0509-67.5. Don't worry about the number. We have to give it a name, so it's a catalog number. There you go. But what you have is this supernova remnant is a very young supernova remnant. It's only 400 years old. So what that means is the ex-companion star, after it flies off when the white dwarf blows up, it won't have had time to move very far, which means it should be really close to the center of this supernova remnant. Also, because the supernova remnant happens to be fairly young, it means it's beautifully symmetric and rather small, which means we can define the center of it to high precision, very good accuracy. Also, That particular supernova remnant happens to be in a very low density, an uncrowded region of the sky. So everything just works perfectly. And so what we've done is we've looked deep in the core, in the very central regions of this, using the Hubble Space Telescope, and what we find is there's no stars there, just none. There's no ex-companion, so the only possible progenitor model is the double degenerate, the one that does not have any ex-companion star left behind. So we actually have a very decisive solution on this. So the statement would be some version of, there are various levels you could call it, but one way of saying it is what we're finding is that for this one particular supernova, that we're finding that there is no possible ex-companion star, and that this decisively and definitively rules out all published models except for one. And that one model that is not excluded is the double degenerate model, where you have two white dwarfs spiraling around in close orbit around each other, spiraling in until they ultimately collide. The mass of the white dwarf gets to the limit, and then it explodes.
You've been listening to astronomer Brad Schaefer. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Sky, heard on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird joins us now with news of the global night sky, and she's here to talk about solar storms. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. In this past week, we've had a couple of big solar storms, and the sun is in a particularly active phase right now. The sun has an 11-year cycle, and right now the sun is in an active part of the cycle, so there are storms going on the sun pretty frequently now. That's in contrast to, say, half a dozen years from now, when there won't be much happening on the sun in terms of solar storms at all. But at the moment, in the year 2012, we have a lot of solar storms going on. And what happens when one of these storms occurs is that charged particles from the sun get released into space. And if a wave of these charged particles strike the Earth, various effects happen, and that causes, instead of it being a solar storm, then it's a geomagnetic storm because the particles interact with the Earth's magnetic field.
Yeah, it creates kind of a storm in our atmosphere.
That's right. So there's this geomagnetic event that takes place, and over the past week, around January 21st and also around January 24th, we had a couple of these big events take place. In fact, the one on the 24th, experts were saying, was the biggest one in the past 7 years. And the thing I want to talk about is that, you know, we put information about these up on our website at earthsky.org, and people in the comments of these posts would say, is the world going to end? Is the world going to end today? because of these solar storms. And I wanted to just get on and say, no.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is the world going to end? Tell us. No, but tell us more about some of this, you know, some of this misunderstanding, some of this fear about solar storms. These storms are perfectly natural, yet they generate a lot of fear when they happen.
Yeah, I mean, storms on the sun have been going on for billions of years since the sun was formed. And all of human history, all of history, the history of life on Earth has evolved, you know, under the auspices of these solar storms that go on, that come and go on the sun. Now the cycle is an 11-year cycle. You know, it's hard to know what that cycle was like billions of years ago. But, you know, there have always been storms on the sun, presumably, and all of human history, for sure, we've had them. And so it's just been kind of surprising that people in here in the year 2012 think that there's, you know, the world is going to end because of a solar storm.
Yeah, I think that there's some, from what I've gathered, it seems to be some confusion about what's happening. The confusion comes from maybe like the storms are doing something that is disabling Earth's natural shield from radiation, you know?
Yeah, and that's not right. Actually, the atmosphere does protect us from this radiation. So if you were an astronaut, up in the International Space Station or in some, say in a craft going from the Earth to the Moon, you would have to worry about a solar storm. You would have to worry about this radiation, this blast of radiation coming from the sun, because you wouldn't have Earth's protective blanket of atmosphere wrapped around you. And, you know, the astronauts in orbit and the astronauts, you know, that used to travel to the moon and back had to have special ways of protecting themselves. But, you know, here on Earth's surface, we don't have to worry about that because we have the atmosphere taking care of us.
Yeah, you know, thousands of years ago, people noticed sunspots that are related to these solar storms. You know, no problem back then. But now today, you know, flash forward thousands of years, we have all kinds of technology that is affected by these solar storms.
Yeah, that's right. The Chinese actually observed spots on the sun thousands of years ago. They also didn't have satellites in orbit around the Earth, and they didn't have cell phones, and they didn't have GPS systems, and they didn't have all the technological things that we have today that can actually be affected by solar storms. So the things that can be affected by solar storms are, for example, telecommunications. So if your cell phone is acting up on the day of a solar storm, well, you can blame that on the sun.
Oh, right. And as we become more vulnerable through our technologies become more vulnerable to solar storms. Also, scientists have been launching new observatories to just see what the sun exactly is doing. There's the SOHO, NASA's SOHO Solar and Heliospheric Observatory. There's also the Solar Dynamic Observatory. These are wonderful instruments out there that are watching what the sun is doing.
They are incredible, Jorge, and there is some incredible video and some incredible imagery that's come out of these observatories that are looking at the sun. And when these solar storms occur, they're beautiful. And there have been some beautiful videos that have resulted from those storms. So we get to see those very beautiful things that also have come from our technology. And in addition, there's one natural phenomenon that occurs as a result of a solar storm that people at very high latitudes can see.
What's that?
Well, I'm talking about the aurora borealis, which is the northern lights. And of course, there's an aurora australis as well, a southern lights on the southernmost part of Earth, mostly seen by people in Antarctica. It's pretty rare that it's seen outside of Antarctica. But the northern lights, because there's more land up at the northern part of Earth, is actually seen at high latitudes, say, the Scandinavian countries or in Canada, northern Russia, places like that. We'll see the northern lights. And when there's a very powerful solar storm, the northern lights can be seen even further south. And there have even been times when they've been seen as far south as here in Texas.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Okote Soul Sounds, Sleep Good, The Boxing Lesson, The Black and White Years, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.